For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hello and welcome to the Modern Adventurer podcast, where explorers and adventurers tell their stories. Coming up,
I got mugged at knife point. So I was riding late in the evening, and a couple of guys on a motorcycle, they pushed me off my bike, and one of them was taking stuff from my bags and stuff, and the other one like held me, and there was a knife like right here. And when you can see the knife and the edge of it shining, suddenly your life flashes in front of you and you do realize what you actually want out of what you're experiencing. And, well, what I wanted was to be alive, basically.
I'm John Horsfall, and on this weekly podcast, we talk to adventurers and explorers from around the world who have made remarkable and daring journeys in recent years. From Everest climbers to polar explorers, world record holders, and many more. I hope this podcast sparks ideas and inspires you to explore and go on your own grand adventure. My next guest is an endurance athlete and adventurer. In 2018, she rode 29,000 kilometers around the world in 160 days, becoming the youngest woman to have cycled the world. Today on the podcast, we speak about her childhood in India and moving to the UK at the age of 18. What inspired her to undertake such an incredible journey, and of course the highs and lows of the round the world trip. So I am delighted to introduce Vedangi Kulkarni to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Well, great to have you on, and you've got quite the story to tell. I mean, you've cycled around the world. You were the youngest female to ever cycle around the world. And I mean, I cannot wait to hear it, but let's start at the beginning and about you and how you sort of got into this adventurous life.
It's well, thank you for the kind words to start with. And as far as my adventurous life is concerned, it wasn't always like that. But what I can definitely say is that my parents have always been incredibly supportive with my strange life decisions. And they've always kind of... I grew up traveling a lot. So every time... So in my culture, there's quite a few... there's quite a few kind of festivals and stuff. So, you know, things that call for a holiday, a school holiday or whatever. So me and my parents used to go for, I don't know, we used to drive across the country and stuff just to see places and experience the journey and, you know, just have a good time. And they were never really, my parents were never really strict about the grades and stuff. They were more cared about the fact that, you know, was I growing up to be a good person, you know, that sort of thing. And I think that was really cool about them. And that meant that they were more open to new opportunities, and they were, yeah, just really open-minded in general. And yeah, I distinctly remember that one of the my first kind of memory of traveling with my parents was when we were all on a moped, actually, and I used to live in like a mountainous kind of region, and I was standing, so I was like tiny, I don't know, 3, 4, whenever your first memories are from, and I was standing in front, you know, where you're meant to keep like your bags and stuff. I was standing there. My mom was riding that moped and my dad was sitting behind. And yeah, like we had traveled for like hundreds of miles like that. And then eventually my parents made like a little seat in front there for me. And yeah, then my mom eventually bought a motorbike and she used to take me to some incredible places on a motorbike. And bear in mind, for a woman riding a motorbike, it was kind of like a taboo. So my mom kind of not just riding a motorbike, but, you know, taking me, her child, with her. And, you know, it was deemed risky. And my mom was more than happy with taking that risk because she's like, this is fun. And I want my daughter to grow up to know that, you know, women can do cool things. And that was incredible.
This was in the mountainous region of India.
Yes. So basically, when I say mountainous, we lived on a plateau, but close to us, there were like really high mountains. So the region that I lived in, it was basically back in the day, there were many forts and on the top of big mountains around there. So yeah, I also grew up hiking in those forts quite a bit, on those forts quite a bit. And yeah, so my dad used to work abroad, and every time he came back, so 1 month on, 1 month off, so he used to work in the middle of oceans and stuff. So that 1 month off that he used to be with us, we would make the most out of it and go places and just, I don't know, we would go for hikes, we would just, you know, have different sorts of experiences. So one of the wildest things I remember, which now when I think about it, they weren't like wild, it was just like something that meant a lot to my family. It was more like me and my parents used to love watching this Bollywood film, and I think it was the film was released when I was like 2 or 3 years old, but when I was like growing up, we used to watch that a lot. And then when I was like 13 or 14, I said to my parents that I want to go and see where the film was filmed. You know, it was like, I want to see the set and everything. And it turned out the set was in the middle of nowhere in one end of Gujarat in like Run of Kutch. And it's like salt plains kind of thing. And you drive in the middle through that and it's beautiful. And to get to that place was a nightmare. Our car was not equipped for that amount of off-road driving. But my mom pulled it through, you know. She took us there. And I remember just me and my dad were so like, oh my God, that's where that happened. And that's where that scene was filmed. And, you know, and it was beautiful and it was really cool. And yeah, now when I think back at it, I think I brought all of the stuff that I learned from that experience and those experiences into the UK when I came here. But before we get to that phase, one last thing would be that the defining moment that kind of, I don't know, played a part in getting me where I am is actually I went for this short trip in the Himalayas with my ex-boyfriend, and I met some really incredible people there who have done like Race Across America and stuff like that. But this guy, he is now like a really kind of someone I look up to, he's my mentor, and he was like, hey, you're really good at the cycling thing, have you considered doing the full route? The full route goes from Manali across these, you know, 4 or 5 mountain passes to Leh, which is like the capital of the Ladakh region, and then, or the biggest city in the Ladakh region, anyway. And then you can go to Srinagar, and it's like a really long route, and, you know, you could do it. And then he was part of Youth Hostel Association of India, but I wasn't allowed to join the group expedition because I was 17 and you need to be at least 18 to do that. So as it turned out, I just joined it by myself. So I didn't go with the group. Instead, I went by myself and my parents were like in the car. They were like, you know, 10 miles somewhere around doing their thing. And I told them that the only time I want to really see you is when I set my camp up. And otherwise, I'm going to be by myself. And I think that experience of being in the Himalayas and knowing, trying to understand my place in the world, and, you know, just kind of being alone in the mountains at very high altitudes and understanding what's around me, that was an interesting experience, which really kind of, yeah, which is where it all started, really.
Well, it's amazing you had such, as I say, supportive parents growing up. Because as we were speaking on the podcast before, very rarely, especially at such a young age, I would have thought parents might have been persuading their kids to sort of move in another direction. And so having such supportive parents at such a young age probably gave you that platform to really express yourself and to pursue these adventures, which, you know, other people might sort of, I don't know, be slightly afraid of, would you say?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And the interesting part is that my parents weren't just kind of supportive in a way that, right, if you're doing this by yourself, go do what you like. They actually kind of encouraged that in a way. So like they were proud of me for doing something different. And even now when I find myself in some really odd places in my mind where I'm like, I just called my dad and I'm like, this was a mistake. Like, this is not happening. I'm not earning enough money. I'm not getting enough support. I'm like, I'm just in this country by myself and not getting it. And my dad's like, I'm proud of you for having those experiences and for where you are. And I'm proud of you for going beyond your comfort zone and, you know, like restarting your whole life in a new country and doing what you do. And he hasn't just been the person who's like, oh, no, it'll be fine. He actually makes me understand that where I am, I'm extremely privileged to be in that position. So, you know, make the most out of it rather than playing yourself down all the time and just kind of, you know, being too hard on yourself, I suppose.
Yeah, I was actually just thinking about one of my trips, and when I was down, I had like horrific injuries, food poisoning, everything, and like absolutely shocking. I remember calling my father, and he just said, "Well, you better carry on," which at the time was not probably what I wanted to hear, but it was almost certainly the right thing.
Yeah.
But now, as you say, just having that sort of support system with it, I imagine was a massive help.
Definitely.
And so you moved to the UK. How old were you when you moved to the UK?
I had just turned 18. And when I say just turned 18, it was within a week of my birthday. So on 12th of September, I turned 18. On 17th of September, I took my flight. And yeah, the first thing I did when I arrived was to put my bike together. Because priorities, eh? Put my bike together. And I was like, so what's this Bournemouth University thing? So what's the deal with having different campuses? How does this work? And I think I had imagined something really different. So when I thought about different campuses, I thought it's just two buildings next to each other and I'm going to the building on the left instead of the building on the right. That was how I envisioned. Instead, it turned out it's like on the other end of the town almost, that sort of thing. And I was like, that's insane. Like, that's beyond what I had imagined, like, a university being like. And then it was such a culture shock. Everything was like, because bear in mind, I landed I had this bike box with me. I had a suitcase and a big, like, massive rucksack with me, like the mountaineering one. And I got there and I was like, so where's Bournemouth then? How do I get there? And I got to Bournemouth station and I was like, so where's Boscombe? Like, how do I get to that place? And this is a big place and everything looks so different. Like, the roads are different. You have to press this button to cross the road. Like, what's the deal with that? And it was kind of like that. And then even, like, taking a taxi and, you know, how British people kind of have that banter in, like, you know, every now and again. I just didn't understand. I remember the taxi guy said something like, oh, big box, I must be, hope there isn't a body in it. And I got so scared. I thought he was accusing me of something. And oh, God, oh, I remember that. And I'm so embarrassed because I was so scared. Lol. Anyway, yeah. First thing I did was put my bike together and go to find wherever my university was and get incredibly shocked that there was more than one building at one campus. And there were, like, multiple buildings which were called different things, and different buildings are for different things, and that it isn't just, like, one massive building and then sections of it. It was just, yeah, just different. It was, like, massive, the campus, and I just couldn't fathom it. And then I was like, okay, so what's this lecture hall thing? And just going in there and realizing that it's like a movie theater. I've only been to, like, 3 movies, like, in a cinema kind of thing. But that's how it felt, because I've never known anything better. So it was really strange. And knowing that the university doesn't run from, like, you know, I don't know, 7 in the morning to 12 in the afternoon, or, like, 9 in the afternoon to 4 in the evening. Like, I was shocked that you actually have, like, a series of lectures at different times of the days, and you just attend them and find a place to hang around. It was really strange just kind of being a foreigner in this country and just looking around.
And so, God, so you sort of had a massive, wake up culture shock to the UK. Was that the idea behind sort of cycling around the UK?
So, no, absolutely not. So, okay. Basically, I was really struggling to make friends, and genuinely struggling. And I, as someone from a very different culture, I didn't know where the boundary was, you know, between people being nice to you and people actually meaning what they're saying, you know, being friends. So if someone said, we should totally catch up and have a cup of tea, you should come over at some point, I would actually go over, and they were only trying to be, you know, polite. They didn't actually mean it. So I was struggling with all of those things and really struggling to actually, like, you know, make good friends, which I understand now that it takes time. But at the time, as someone, I felt incredibly lonely. So I took up cycling for long distances, and I didn't just take it up. I used to ride from Bournemouth to Exeter, stay somewhere under a bus shelter or something strange like that, and then ride back the next day. Or, like, I would just ride to some odd places that I would see in the map and be like, oh, I wonder what this place is like or that place is like. And I would just ride there, and I would stay somewhere, come back and be like, and just, like, kind of slip it into conversations with people, you know, kind of be like, oh, yeah, I went to Exeter. I rode to Exeter and back the other weekend. They would be like, you did what? And even I didn't realize that Exeter was actually quite far and it's quite hilly along the way. All I knew, I had my bike, I think it's like 100 quid. Like, I got it from India, and that's like 100 quid bike. And for me, it was the best bike ever because it had taken me across Himalayas, and, you know, I was, like, stoked about it. And then my mentor from India, he suggested, he was like, have you heard of London Edinburgh London? It's an Audax event. It's 1400 kilometers. You've got 5 days to do it. And I was like, I'm signing up. signed up for it and realized that I actually need to train for it because it's a long distance. So a part of my training was this 400 kilometer ride. So I was going to go from Bournemouth to London and back. Instead, when I started off with that ride, and bear in mind, I had a saddle pack, the Apidura 17 liter one, and a backpack with me. And there wasn't much, like there was no sleeping gear. There was just clothes and water and shit tons of food that I probably didn't even need. And I didn't even have a proper puncture repair kit. That's what we're talking. I was unprepared. Left, and as things go, my bike had something wrong with it. So in this small village called Bentley in Hampshire, I was fixing my bike, got into a conversation with a really kind of really like amazing lady, and got invited to, you know, sleep over at hers, and was telling stories to her daughter and her family, and it was really cool. And then I was asked where I'm going, and I was like, right, can't say I'm only going back to Bournemouth now, can I? So I just pointed to John O'Groats on the map, and that was that. I didn't know the route. I didn't know how to get to John O'Groats. I thought Reading was pronounced as Reading. And I just thought it would be a good idea. So that's how the whole kind of riding across from Bournemouth to John O'Groats happened. And even like the word John O'Groats, it was something it didn't make sense to me, you know. If that, I was like, oh wow, that's a strange word. It would be fun to say it out loud. That's how, like, you know, I know it sounds like really bizarre, but that's actually how it was. That's how stupid I was to just be like, oh, that looks funny. That also looks like end of the country. Oh, I wonder if I can ride there. Cool, I'm going to ride there. And just pointed out at all of the major cities along the way, and yeah, got there in the end through some incredibly strange experiences, like sleeping in the bus shelters, knocking on random people's doors, hoping someone would, you know, put me up for the night. Didn't know that's not how you do it in this country, but, you know, people are kind. What can I say? Like, and again, like, at the time, I really was that dumb foreigner who doesn't understand anything or who can't even speak English. I had a very strong accent, like I didn't speak properly. So, you know, I couldn't even speak in proper kind of, I don't know. I didn't have any consistency in the way I spoke English, if that makes sense. And I couldn't understand other people either. So that kind of added to the whole experience. So, yeah, I happened to meet someone who had auditioned for the same Bollywood film that I had auditioned for. She had played this, I don't even remember. She had played a wrestler, and I had auditioned for a part playing opposite her. but yeah, I hadn't got it, by the way.
Well, I think to do this, you need a sort of slight sense of naivety. Because otherwise, I think otherwise, if you go knowing everything, and you go with a sense of all the sort of horror stories that you usually get told about, you wouldn't get started.
Exactly.
And to have that sort of sense of naivety, I think really helps, because I think people work off that. And that is why, in a sense, sometimes why people are so kind. Maybe they saw pity on me when I did it. But I think it also helps slightly. Having that, you sort of slept in bus shelters, wild camped. I mean,
without,
God, what a
without
sort of story.
Any sleeping kit, that was.
Yeah.
now, when I think about it, now my job is planning expeditions and adventures, or, you know, managing other people's expeditions, assessing risks and marketing and stuff. And now, when I think about it, I'm like, everything I did then was against everything I would suggest other people to do now. But having that wild edge is something that we all need in spite of all the planning. But yeah, it's interesting that. But that was also the beginning of my bigger dream of getting around the world in 100 days, which also, by the way, the 100 days bit didn't happen, but we'll get there. When I was riding to John O'Groats, obviously, I didn't have anyone other than my parents and a few Facebook friends to report back to about how my days are going. So I just felt incredibly lonely. So I was reading a book called This Road I Ride by Juliana Buring, and that was where I found out about this record about, you know, getting around the world, circumnavigating the world on bicycle. It's like, wow, that's also a thing. But is it something that I want to do? Is it something that I can do? And with this whole kind of questioning if that was something I wanted to do and if I could do, I would like just read more and more of her book along the way. And as I got to John O'Groats, I had finished the book. I was just sitting there and thinking to myself how none of what I've done had been planned, how none of what I had done had been trained for, and still we made it across the fucking country. So what are we waiting for? We can probably do more than this. So the next kind of progression to that for me was riding my bike around the world. That's where the dream came from. And yeah, that was where it all started.
How much planning did it sort of take to get that expedition off the ground?
Oh, a lot more than I was prepared for. A lot more than I was prepared for, with a lot less patience than I think I have now. Let's put it that way. Many, many months. And I didn't know many people in the industry. Oh, many people. I didn't know any people in the industry. I just knew that I had a big dream and I was very tiny and I needed to train for it. So my university took pity on me, probably. Probably I did that bit out. My university was incredibly helpful in setting up the training resources for me. So there was a personal trainer and all that. But being strong enough to do something doesn't ensure that you do it. You need to have money for it. You need to know how to put yourself out there. And my way of doing that was DMing thousands of people who I thought would know more than I do, and just asking them questions and learning from them. So Mark Beaumont, for example, I met him. I rode to Kendal Mountain Festival from Bournemouth. I rode to Kendal to meet him. And talked to him about this, and he was incredibly helpful with helping me understand what I need to have in place to pull something like this off. And that was so helpful. And I remember it was quite surreal with like him, Sean Conway, and myself at like Brewery Arts Centre. And I didn't even like beer, but I had quite a few of those. And I was just like, I can't believe this is happening, because if I'm talking about this to these legends, I actually have to do it. And then, yeah, eventually, it was hard work getting the funds together, because I had sent 512 or something like that emails, and only 12 of them got back with a positive response. Probably in total, not more than 30 people got back full stop. So it did take that much effort, but that was because I knew nothing about which brands to approach, what research to do, and what questions to ask, how to present myself to certain brands, and how am I unique in what I'm doing, and how can I actually make a point of that. I knew none of that. All I knew is that, oh, I have a dream, which is to, you know, ride my bike around the world. I don't have a track record. I've only, like, ridden my bike kind of across the Himalayas and across the UK. But again, like, that's not a big deal. And I just played everything down. I didn't understand even a little bit how to make it sound like something at all. Or, you know, so it was very hard to be prepared for this. And at some point I ran out of money, and my dad had to help me, which was incredibly embarrassing, but at the same time very generous of him. So yeah.
And so you took off, what, from the UK to cycle around the world?
No. So one of my incredibly stupid, am I allowed to say that? One of my not so good decisions was to start and finish in Australia. I don't know why I thought that. It was just really random. I was like, I want to go to Australia and I'm going to have to go there anyway. So why don't I just start and finish there? When else am I going to get to enjoy the country? I'll tell you later why it was not a great idea to finish there. Anyway, started from Perth across Australia, Perth to Brisbane. Flew to Wellington to Auckland, so across North Island of New Zealand, flew to Vancouver, and took an incredibly zigzag route across Canada into Halifax. And yeah, I realized I wasn't going to get a US visa, so I had to like cover more distance than I should have in Canada. Anyway, to Halifax and then Iceland, but then I couldn't go all the way across Iceland because of an accident. So Portugal, flew to Portugal. Portugal, Spain, France, Belgium, Germany, Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Russia. Russia was only from the Finnish border to Ufa. And then from there, I flew to India and did this weird route across India. And then from there I had finished 29,000 kilometers, 18,000 miles. So from there, I flew back to Australia. So that was the route.
Wow. And I mean, God, that's amazing. Because we had Mark Beaumont on the podcast and he was talking about sort of logistics of a round the world cycle and sort of getting it sort of officiated by the Guinness Book of Records. And just sort of, as you say, the sort of logistics behind it. Was it more of an experience, or was the record important to you?
At the time, it was very important, but when I'd already started, I did some stuff that, stuff like, at some point, I just stopped caring about my logbook. I still had it, and I still took the signatures, but I was just, like, very kind of reluctant to, if that makes sense, or even stuff like, not kind of bothering to back up my data and stuff like that. That meant that, like, yeah, I don't know. So it meant a lot to me, the actual record bit. But some stuff happened to me on the way, which made it obvious that I wasn't going to get it. So halfway, I was in 55 days, so 9,020 miles I'd done in 55 days. And I only realized when I was asked about it that I actually don't have consistent evidence of that. So one thing that really bothered me was the spot tracker. It just made me incredibly aware and incredibly less adventurous. Like, it just reduced the whole fun factor for me. So I just turned it off. I was just like, fuck it. And obviously that's not the way to go, but go and tell that to the 19-year-old me. Like, you know, she took some weird decisions and, yeah, whatever. So I, at the time, even if the record meant so much for me, I almost expected to get it without actually bearing to the consequences of it, like actually having that pressure of the spot tracker, actually having the kind of pressure of, oh shit, I need to back this up, or oh shit, I need to take the signature, and then again next time, like when I stop somewhere, I have to get it there, and then again, and you know, all of that was just like overwhelming. Because also another thing to remember was that in some parts of the world, Antil Films had offered to like support with some filming, but again my attempt was unsupported. So what ended up happening was that I selected a couple of people, one of them was like a friend of mine, to join the film crew and kind of, you know, film some bits of this ride. And what actually ended up happening was that they joined, but I was doing the logistics for most of it. So that meant that it was just overwhelming, to say the least. And one thing I had learned was that I can either have fun and strictly have fun, or I can actually like also remember the other stuff and actually like take that pressure. So until the halfway point, I was doing both very well. And then Spain happened. In Spain, I'm not sure if I've told, like if you've heard about the story before, but I got mugged at knife point. So I was riding late in the evening, and a couple of guys on a motorcycle, they pushed me off my bike, and one of them was taking stuff from my bags and stuff, and the other one like held me, and there was a knife like right here. And when you can see the knife and the edge of it shining, suddenly your life flashes in front of you and you do realize what you actually want out of what you're experiencing. And well, what I wanted was to be alive, basically. But anyway, eventually we found that, it was just me, there was no silk at that point. I was looking at the license plate of the motorbike and I was memorizing the numbers, but what ended up happening was they took what they had to, pushed me along the edge of this road. I fell off head first. And then I heard a thud, which I later found out was my bike falling on me. And I think I was unconscious for, I don't know how long, but I got up, and whenever I got up, I was like, shit, that's my bike. And then I was like, is my frame bag still there? And it was. So I kind of pulled my head torch out of there, because when you're essentially living on your bike, you know where everything is, isn't it? So I pulled my head torch off, out, and found my way back to the road. Walked to this gas station, must have been like 5 or so kilometers. So a good kind of hour, if not more. And this guy must have felt incredibly bad for me, because he literally just shut everything there and he was like, right, we need to, like, I need to help you, that sort of thing. So he took me for a coffee to this place, like, behind. It was like a motel kind of place. So my lips were bleeding, my nose was bleeding, and they were like, I was basically, like, a bit bruised. I was not looking good, you know? And I didn't remember much at all. I just remembered this number that I was memorizing to keep fear away as much as I could. So I had memorized this number, which started with a B, ended with a 6. And I kept repeating it to this guy. And he didn't understand a thing. But this family was like, ah, that's a number of a motorcycle. Like, you know, the structure of the numbers is like of a motorcycle. Anyway, they were like, they encouraged me to report it, which I did. I was taken to a hospital. We found out that I had concussion. I couldn't keep much food down. I couldn't kind of drink properly. My head hurt quite a bit. I couldn't balance much on my bike. I was just like really in a bad place. At that point, I just decided that I wasn't going for the fastest record anymore. And also, like, I got back on the road within the next 48 hours. well, within the next 40 hours, wasn't going for the record anymore. I was going incredibly slow. It's taking me so long to get anywhere. And I just felt really rough for thousands of miles after that, really. Because bear in mind, I was doing... It took me... I remember the first time I did 100 kilometers after the concussion incident was within a week of that, and that took me 8 hours because I could climb, I could do the climbs, but I couldn't do the downhills. I just couldn't balance. Like, if someone honked at me, I would get out of the road and I would cry. I cried so much. Like, I now get bruises under and over my eyes if I cry a lot, because I don't know, like, I think it's from that, because I'd broken my nose or something. It's insane how much I had cried in those few days or months after that. But yeah, after that, I decided to continue, and then I took another fun decision to instead of resting for 8 days until my Russian visa was there in Finland, I was like, no. I don't want to rest. So I went to the Arctic Circle. I took a plane to Ivalo, took a bus to Inari, and then, like, went for a hike in the forest there with my friend's kind of backpack, and left my bike at my friend's kind of mum's house. And just, yeah, I was just like, yeah, I'm just going to learn how to deal with the snow and how to survive in the snow from the people that I meet over there, which I did. And yeah, then came back, got my Russian visa, cycled in through Russia in winter, which was a really interesting experience. And yeah, definitely something I won't forget in a hurry.
Yeah, we had Geordie Stewart on, who cycled through Siberia, and he said, you know, the temperatures drop so low in that area, and it's really inhospitable.
It is.
And from there, I mean, you were, what, you got through Russia and then flew to India, is that right?
Yeah, so I went from the Finnish and Russian border, rode all the way to Ufa from there. And then, yeah, one of the interesting experiences, actually, before I get to the India bit, was that a 5-star hotel offered to host me for free, just because I called them up from outside Moscow and I told them what I was doing, and I told them that I need a place to stay, and I just looked at you a hotel in Samara, and can I get a booking and something like that? I don't remember what I said, but I knew they spoke English, and at that point I could only speak people in, I could only expect people in cities to speak English at that point, because I'd learned that soon enough that in the rural areas people wouldn't quite know English. And I got to Samara, and there were these very well-dressed people applauding as I walked up my bike up this kind of stairway. And as it turned out, and then the minute I stopped, they stopped and they took stuff off my bike. And I was like, oh, wait, they were clapping for me. Oh, thank you. Like, it was literally like that. Initially, I had thought there was like a Russian celebrity or something behind, but apparently not. And they baked me this beautiful cake, it had written, "We believe you can do it." And that was so nice, like really nice. And they offered me hot tub and stuff, and like, you know, they offered me their best room. Gave me a lot of food, which I needed at that point, like, you know, and they were incredibly kind to me. And yeah, I'll never forget that experience. So that was really cool. And then I obviously continued my ride to Ufa, and from Ufa I flew to India. And then, yeah, there was a ride I don't even remember. Was it 5,000 or 6,000? Or somewhere in between kilometers in India. And that was interesting because I had been by myself for so long. Like, when you've ridden 24, 25,000 kilometers by yourself and you've been in your own head for so long, and suddenly you're in a country that you recognize places, recognize language, and recognize people in. And I can't even describe how it felt. And my parents said they would again drive in like 50 to 100 kilometer radius, and they were like, you can decide where you want to stay, and you know, you can do your own payments and do that. We won't like support you, but we need to know that you're okay, because you've almost died thrice in the last 3 months. So I thought that was fair, because once I got chased by a bear, second time the whole thingy, you know, with the horrible people in Spain, with the people who mugged me, that, and at the Finnish-Russian border, I had like I kind of pulled something that didn't quite work. I told them that I gave them a passport and a visa, and they were asking for money, and I said I'm not going to give them any money, and they were like insisting that they wouldn't let me enter without money, without like giving them some money, and I was like, I'm going to call my lawyer. And I didn't even have any signal or a SIM card for that matter. And I just pretended to call someone, and I was speaking to them very loudly, kind of like trying to make a statement that, you know, fuck you, let me in kind of thing. And then, yeah, they had to let me in because they thought I was going to sue them or something. And yeah. But because of kind of a few of those experiences, and also the fact that I had lung infection back in Canada, so that didn't help either. So like, because my parents knew all those things now, they were like, god, she, like, I would just want to make sure she pulls it through, like, you know, India, so that she has actually done what she wants to. So they were like, you know, they were supportive, but not increasingly. Like, you know, they weren't allowed to be. I was just like, stay away from me, but it's good that you're there. But then it was also really strange mentally because of the familiarity and just knowing that I wasn't all by myself. That was really strange. But yeah, then I finished on Christmas Eve in Australia. And that was bizarre. So I had run out of my Australian visa within the last week of my ride through India. And then I had to apply for like an emergency visa, which arrived. I got my visa on my way to the airport. So I had booked my flight without having a visa in place. Living life on the edge, what can I say? and yeah, then I got my visa, reached Australia on Christmas Eve. And it was literally just my parents and me and the like Marathi community kind of center there, and like no kind of friends or like that sort of thing, which I would have loved to, you know, have at the finish line, because I was looking forwards to that part so much and for so long. And on Christmas Day, everything was closed. So instead, I just sat with my dad in that hotel, and the hotel's bar actually, and just, we told the hotel what, like, I had just come back from. So we had an open tap for like cocktails, so I had quite a few of those. That was literally my that was Christmas Day 2018 now.
On your trips, I mean, it's just a absolutely incredible story. What, and you know, that sort of time in the Russian hotel with them sort of putting you up and putting on a show, what were the sort of other moments that really stuck out to you from that trip?
Oh, okay. Day two of riding, and I am already riding through some terrain that feels like I'm in the middle of nowhere in Australia, soon approaching Nullarbor. Quickly approaching Nullarbor, and this guy who had like silver teeth and a very gangstery look. He's driving in this truck with his mate, I want to say. Anyway, I'm riding and he's throwing cans of Coke at me. Like, you know, offering me that as such, like whilst we were both kind of, I was riding and he was driving. I caught it, put it in my pocket, kept riding. And then he throws another can of Coke at me. And I'm like, cool, okay, this guy's nice. I get it, put it in my pocket, keep going. And after four cans of Coke, he signals me to stop. So I'm like, fuck, now I have to stop. We don't, like, you know, sometimes you look at people and you, when you're by yourself and when you're in the middle of nowhere, mostly bad things run through your mind. At least they did at that point, because probably I had to be a little judgmental to protect myself at that point. So stopped, and this guy tells me that he has been in prison before. And he tells me that he's got like guns and stuff with him. Then he proceeds to give me a lot of hugs and a lot of high fives every other sentence. And yeah, he just looks and sounds very like gangstery. And then when I'm sneakily taking my phone out of the pocket, he takes my phone from me, dials his number, and calls on his own phone and then gives me my phone back and says, now you have my number. I'm the one you call. Then he called his family. And then he had me talk to them and introduced me to his daughters and his wife and took photos with me and was incredibly kind. And he kept checking in on me like over the next few days. And yeah. Interesting man, but never judge a book by its cover, as they say. And he was only looking out for me, as it turned out, and, you know, just being incredibly nice.
Wow, it is amazing, those sort of stories. And as you say, some of the people along the way on these trips that one does is incredible. What was the sort of motivation? Because you went through quite a few hardships. What was the sort of motivation in the back of your head that sort of kept you going? You know, after you've been mugged and beaten in Spain, a lot of people might have thought of quitting. What was in the back of your mind that kept you going? Was it the motivation to break the record or to complete the circuit of around the world?
It wasn't. It definitely wasn't to break a record anymore. I'll tell you that right now. What it was at that point was that I had nowhere else to go. My UK visa had expired. My parents lived in Oman. I didn't want to go to India. Or, well, there was nowhere specific that I could go to India. And when I thought of home, I thought of my, like, of the student house in the UK where all my friends were. So the home for me in that moment was where I was and what I was doing. So I had to get back into that to feel comfortable again. And believe me, when you're concussed and when you decide to keep riding, you need to find something comfortable, something, anything. So for me, it was just talking to my friends for hours and hours on end on phone whilst riding, counting frogs on the road, dead frogs on the road, or like, you know, like some really strange things, just, you know, some, and again, like, I wanted to continue because I knew that if I did not, I was going to get to a place which was darker inside of my own head, and I had no idea how long it would take for me to get out of there if I didn't continue. And I know, like, right now, so how many years has it been? 2.5 years after finish, the only thing I regret is not having enough collective evidence of my ride. If I hadn't finished it, I would have had bigger regrets. I would have regretted not having completed it. I would have hated myself for it. And that's just how much I knew myself, which pushed me to keep going. And because I knew that when I'll be back, it will be a story to tell. And I knew that it wasn't going to be all bad. So I know cycling in winter sounds awful in Russia, but when I got there, yes, it was cold and miserable for a lot of it, but when it wasn't, riding in the night, it was just incredible shiny snow all around with only like that black light to focus on and, sorry, black light, white light to focus on in the dark. And like it just kind of, every time I like think about it, I see exactly what I was seeing then. And I don't regret that at all. I would have felt really bad if I hadn't done it, you know, or even the Arctic experiences that I had in the middle of my, when my Russian visa was being processed, like, it would have been horrible if I hadn't done that. Like, I would have not felt good about myself now. And earlier when we were talking about the incomplete feeling in yourself, by not doing certain things or by not having done certain things and then pushing yourself and doing those things and finding out how you actually feel about it. Like, I think that's what kind of motivated me, because until I was done with it, something always felt incomplete. And then when I was done, only the evidence part of it felt incomplete, which I was fine with. Well, I wasn't fine with it for a long time. I was like, no, I want recognition. I want to be accepted and, you know, all of that. And now I think about it, I'm like, hey, look, I had all of those experiences with very less pressure. And I actually had fun. So, yeah, that was what it was. I know it's not probably the answer you were looking for. I'm sorry for that.
No, it was. It's amazing because, as you say, I mean, one of mine was the sort of fear of missing out what might happen tomorrow. That was sometimes one of my greatest fears, is you might miss the most exciting, the most incredible experience by not going on to the finish.
Yeah.
And like with all these trips, the end is always quite hollow, and it's always it never quite lives up to how one might imagine, but it's actually the experiences in between that really matter.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm sure there's probably someone saying, no, the world record was amazing for me. Thank you very much.
Oh, God. I mean, I will say that. I would have quite liked that. I had trained so hard to make sure that my body was ready to pull 200 miles a day and make it around the world in 100 days. But that's not how it works. That's just not how life works, is it? Like, you don't really get what you need, what you want. You get what you need. What was that phrase? Something on those lines, isn't it? I'm not wise enough to say that, but someone else has said that and I just copied it.
Well, I mean, it's just an incredible story. And thank you so much for sharing it today. There's a part of the show where we ask the same five questions to each guest each week. With the first being, on your trip or expeditions, what's the one gadget that you always take with you?
Anything that plays music. In the deepest, darkest times, I need my music. I need my Queen playlist. I need to play somebody to love.
there you have it. What about your favorite adventure book?
Oh, favorite adventure book. There's so many. I recently read Anna McNuff's, Adventure Stories for Adults? Bedtime Stories for Adults. Anyway, that one, I quite like that. There's so many that I actually like and enjoy. Like, I really like Juliana Buring's This Road I Ride, because that started so many beautiful things for me. So I'm going to go with that as well.
Why are adventures important to you?
Because that's where I feel more myself. When I'm riding my bike or when I'm kind of walking through terrains that are, I don't know, unfamiliar to me, that's where I feel like I thrive, under kind of conditions which are out of my control. And I also feel very, well, obviously the incredible sense of freedom that comes through adventure is something that I didn't think I should mention, because it kind of is obvious. But yeah, just feeling more myself and feeling in control of my reactions and yeah, what I'm doing and, you know, my decisions and just the self-sufficient feeling.
Favorite quote?
The only way out is through. That was written on my bike by this guy called Abdullah Zainab, who won Trans Am bike race back in 2019, I want to say. And he got the course record for it, I think. I could be wrong. I don't know about the course record, but he won it by miles and miles, if not days. It was incredible. He is incredible. He filmed the first half of my Australian ride. And before continuing, I asked him to, because he's such a legend, I was like, you got to write something that I am going to want to remind myself of on my bike. And on a sticky note, he wrote, the only way out is through. And yeah, that was it. Like, ever since then, every time I find myself in a sticky situation, that's what I tell myself. The only way out is through.
I think, yeah, what was another one? The first one through the wall is always the bloodiest.
That's a good one. I like that.
No, I mean, there's so many for it. So, I mean, you could reel off so many.
Just quickly, favorite adventure book. I just realized the book that I really go back to, like, and I can listen to it or read it however many times that I want to, is Mind of a Survivor by Megan Hine. Like, on the days that I don't want to ride my bike, or I am somewhere that I need to keep going, otherwise I wouldn't get anywhere with my ride. Like, if when I found myself in these situations, I always tuned her book. I just always tuned into her book, and I started it from like chapter one, and I knew exactly at what point what chapter would come up and how long the audiobook lasts for. When I'm reading, I know how long have I got left to complete reading. Like, I've just read it that many times. And yeah, Megan Hine is totally badass. And she's like a, yeah, incredible female role model for me.
Oh, amazing. People listening are always keen to travel and go on these sort of grand expeditions. What's the one thing that you would recommend for people wanting to get started?
To just get started would be the recommendation, because most of the incredible things that happen when you actually do take that first step. And obviously it's not obvious at the time. It does feel like there's something always incomplete. There's never actually going to be the perfect time to get started. So yeah, stick to your own schedule. Don't let other people tell you that you haven't prepared enough, you are not enough, like, you need to do more and think more and have more to get started with what you want to get started with. Like, don't let other people dictate that on you. Like, if you think you're ready, and even if you don't think you're ready, if you've set a date, then, you know, do it when that date has come, or, you know, just get started.
No, very, very good. Finally, what are you doing, and how can people follow your adventures in the future?
Ooh, that's complicated, what I'm doing. I am doing a lot of things right now. So I do a lot of freelance writing for different magazines and websites. I am writing a book right now. I'm running a business called The Adventure Shed, through which I help manage and plan expeditions and adventures for people. And, you know, help with the logistics, the finances and sponsorships and all that, marketing, all that sort of stuff. And I'm also kind of, I'm doing some project management stuff. So I'm setting up a mountain biking race soon. And then I'm also setting up an adventure festival somewhere that I can't mention just yet. So yeah, I'm doing a lot of things, and then I'm training for Silk Road Mountain Race. Last time I tried it, that didn't go well, so this time we'll see. Yeah, I'm going to look at it as an adventure, not a race, so that I actually get through it. But yeah, so that's kind of the stuff that I'm doing right now. And as of tomorrow, I'll be back on the road for the second half of an adventure. As for where you can find me, you can find me on my social media channels. So on Instagram and Twitter, I am at Wheels and Words, so WHEELSWORDS. That's Wheels and Words. And yeah, on Facebook, I'm Vedangi Kulkarni. Yeah, that's where you can find me. And yeah, if you're planning your next adventure, please do email me. I would love to chat about it. And I recently launched something called Adventure Planning Blueprint, which is a document where you can literally, you can use that document to plan your adventure from start to end. And it includes the templates and resources that are necessary to put your stuff like together. And everything from like framing a sponsorship email, for example, or a proposal, or, you know, creating a marketing plan for that matter, like all that sort of stuff, but also route plan, risk management and stuff like that. It's all there.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure listening to your stories, and I can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me, and yeah, it's been great, and I feel like chatting about my adventures today is going to help me for the adventure that I'm about to like set off on tomorrow. So yeah, well, thank you so much.
Well, we'll be following, and again, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. You can watch the podcast on YouTube now, and don't forget to subscribe and sign up to the monthly newsletter, which is in the description below. I hope you enjoyed the show, and if you did, tag me on Instagram at John Horsfall. I'm always keen to connect with other adventurers, and I look forward to next week for another fascinating tale of adventure. But till then, have a great day and happy adventures.